Okay, this is our last class of the season, and this shiur is dedicated, as were all of the other ones, Le'ilui Nishmas Rechalei Abbas Reb Chaim Tzvi. So what we're going to be talking about today, our final halacha of the season, is going to be a collection of halachot in our behavior between man and man. The reason I selected this for our next topic is because, as we know, the second temple, the second Beis HaMikdash, was destroyed because of senseless hatred. And, of course, nobody gets up in the morning and says, I feel like hating. Senselessly. So I think I'll, and then they choose whoever they choose. There are behaviors that lead to hatred, and there are also ways of thinking that lead to hatred. So we're going to be talking about, initially, our behaviors, not thoughts, that take away from love and create hatred, and other behaviors that express hatred and therefore deepen it. Some of them will be familiar to you and some of them will not. Let's begin with hatred. The halachic definition of hatred isn't like the way we use this word in common language. In common language, the word is vulgar and inappropriate to use in almost any situation. In halachic language, it's a description that's very much the opposite of love. If love is empathetic connection, wanting it to be good for the other person because they're in a certain sense you, hatred is the exact opposite. It's detachment. It's alienation. So the same way with love, there are many, many levels of empathetic connection. You're walking down the street and you see someone trip and you help them up. There's a certain degree of connection just because they're human. You can't compare that connection to the connection you have with someone who you love more deeply. Similarly, there are different levels of alienation. There are people who seem threatening, who you want out of your life. Okay, there are people who you should want out of your life. In fact, that all hatred is senseless. So, there are different sorts of hatred. The worst hatred is hatred in one's heart. The definition of hatred in one's heart is when you feel the alienation. We're acting as though everything is okay on the surface. Other authorities maintain there has to be at least one symptom, and the symptom would have to be going out of one's way to not greet someone, where you don't want to talk to them. So that would be hatred. The definition of senseless would be that there isn't a halachic obligation to give them rebuke, which they wouldn't have received properly. So what does that mean concretely? That means if any person, any Jewish person, does something that's wrong in halacha, and they're able to hear rebuke, and I'll give you conditions for that, your obligation is to help them recover, to feel enough empathetic understanding of where they are, that you would want to help them get back on track the same way if you got off the subway on the wrong stop, which could be a nightmare. You would welcome somebody saying, no, don't turn there. Go straight two more blocks. You'll find another train station. You can go down and take the train back where you came from. Okay, you would want guidance. And ideally, a person who's off track could be approached with enough love and enough compassion that they'll trust you as a guide. So if somebody authentically did something wrong, then the response should be, Guidance has conditions. The conditions would be, first of all, adapting the mindset of approaching this with the intent of seeing the other person as you, the person who got off the stop at the wrong place. That means reviewing times in your life where you made mistakes and how you would have wanted others to go about correcting you. So the steps would then include speaking to them about whatever is wrong privately, not through someone, not in the presence of someone, since as long as there's no audience, there's at least a possibility of avoiding defensiveness. But once there's an audience, then you're both playing for the audience. You may be playing trusted guide, but they're going to be played misunderstood, innocent person, which is not what you need and not what they need. So no other people. The next step is talking to them about the action itself. Some of you may have read Let Me Understand You, Men Are From Mars, Women From Venus, and similar books. A theory there is that when a woman feels distress, because women on an intuitive level want to avoid distress, usually 10% of their bad feelings have to do with the current situation, and 90% is history. So you have to train yourself to focus on the 10% that's current, which means ideally not letting a great deal store up, which doesn't mean pestering people every 5 minutes, but it does mean sometimes working through it yourself. But certainly not coming at somebody with things that may be years old all at once, because no one could handle that. The next step is telling them what you want them to do. You have to give them an escape latch. The step after that is affirming this, that you value their intent to do it, so that you equalize the relationship. So that's how not to keep hatred in your heart, in most circumstances. But what about if the problem is not something they've done? What about the problem is the way they are? And again, if you look at non-Jewish sources, there are all sorts of topology systems, practical, judgmental, emotional, there are 8 different types. What if you're just very different types? There are people, for instance, who are passionate and warm and can't relate to somebody who's more detached and more inward. There are other people who are practical and down to earth and can't understand why somebody has a need to theorize everything. Conversely, the person who needs to theorize may find the other person somewhat primitive, somewhat unsophisticated in their thinking. So the premise is, and we spoke about this last time, and this is going to end our review of last time, the premise is that you have to approach every situation with these questions. What could I learn from this person? How could I help this person? And then everything changes. What we're going to talk about now are concrete traps that people sometimes fall into. The first one is revenge. So the classical example of revenge is when you knock on my door, you ask to borrow my hammer. I say, no, I don't lend out tools, that way if I need them, I don't know where they are exactly, I'm so sorry. So you have no choice, you go out and buy a hammer. Time passes, I knock at your door to say, I'm in the middle of hanging up a picture and the hammer had broke off, could I use your hammer just for a little bit? Say, well, I have a policy, I don't lend out my tools to strangers because, you know, I might need it and I never know where it is. And the reason you're saying that isn't because you have such a policy. In fact, you would lend it to anybody else. It's because you want them to feel the pain that you felt. You call that teaching them a lesson. So the Torah forbids taking revenge. And there are several reasons for this, but the first thing that I think we have to really go into is that revenge feels very, very, very sweet. So getting past revenge is not going to be an easy task. So let's first try to understand why it feels so sweet. So the reason is that when a person suffers, this isn't so rational, and we don't always work rationally. When a person suffers, their intuitive feeling tells them that they've somehow been belittled. This is why, again, intuitively, a child falls. The mother will pick up the child and kiss the child. Now, the child doesn't feel hated. They fell on the pavement, let's say. But the suffering creates vulnerability, and vulnerability makes a person feel belittled, small, unable to cope. Similarly, as adults, when we're injured in any way whatsoever, we feel belittled, we feel vulnerable, we feel unable to cope. So this feeling is sharpened by the fact that oftentimes the person who brought about that feeling is okay. They have the hammer. They're the man. They're running the show. They seem powerful. They seem intact. And not only that, but they may seem frightening. Again, all of this is intuitive and none of this is rational, but that doesn't mean that the feelings aren't real. So the sweetness of revenge is that we equalize the relationship. We take a relationship in which you feel vulnerable and somebody else seems powerful, and you cut down their legs, so to speak, so they're both in the same plane. They're vulnerable too. What's wrong with this picture? So what's wrong with this picture is that life isn't all about feeling small and vulnerable and suffering pain. The reason why Hashem puts us in any situation in life is always to uplift us. So the fact that you may feel vulnerable may be a means towards an end. It's never an end in itself. So your role in the other person's life is also to uplift them. When you take revenge, instead of uplifting yourself and uplifting them, what you do is you belittle them so that they feel as vulnerable as you do. Now, there's another problem with revenge. The other problem is revenge is that you become what you hate. So let's go back to our very, very simple example with the hammer. You didn't like it when the guy has a hammer and you're their next door neighbor, and he tells you he doesn't let out his tools. What you felt like saying that you didn't say, what do you mean you don't like letting out your tools? I'm your next door neighbor. What do you think I'm going to do, take it to China? And what's the big deal anyway? It's a $7 hammer. What's the worst thing that could happen? But you didn't say any of this. But you felt it. So at that point, if you do the same thing to them, you become everything you accuse them of being. Incompassionate, callous, what they say in Hebrew, atum, which means blocked. You have this invisible, opaque shield separating you from from other human beings. Cheap. Everything you didn't like in that person, you've just developed in yourself. So what happens is that you're conditioning yourself to be everything that you hate. So the question is, what should you do with the feelings? This person is at your door. So here's a saccharine, also forbidden response, which is called bearing a grudge. Give a smile and say, sure, no problem. I mean, some people can't part with a hammer. Thank God, I've never been the kind of person who for a $7 hammer would turn a neighbor down. Here, take it. That's called bearing a grudge, because even though you're actually giving your neighbor the hammer, what are you still trying to do? You're still playing the same game. I felt vulnerable and small. I want you to feel vulnerable and small. You're not doing it. It's not happening. You're not getting uplifted through this. So what would be a better response? Are you ready? Hold on to your seats. If you have the hammer, just say, sure, and give him the hammer. That's it. No speech. No soapbox. No smirk. When you do this, you become the person you want to be. Less vulnerable, less afraid of life, more willing to take risks. You become braver and bigger. And what happens to the other person? So your Yetzer Hara will tell you, the person will say, ha ha ha, what a fool. It's not what's going to happen. Let's look at the best case and the worst case. The best case will be regret that they didn't lend you the hammer. That's the best case. But you didn't cause it. It's coming from within the person. It's integrated and it could change their behavior. What's the worst thing that could happen? The worst thing that could happen is that they could delete the fact that they didn't lend you their hammer, ignore it, and just use your hammer and give it back. In which case, you still built yourself, but you didn't succeed in building them because they didn't let you. And the truth is, of course, the only life that you could live is whose? Your own. You can't live their life in any case. So this is the idea of revenge and bearing a grudge. Okay, let's go further. There's another isser that people have to be made aware of in relationships, which is called ona'a. What's ona'a? Ona'a, and this is very close conceptually to revenge and grudge bearing, is purposely selecting words that you know will hurt. Different people are hurt by different things. When you purposely try to say anything that you know will hurt the person, Usually it's because, again, they made you feel bad, small, vulnerable. So again, you're in the same fix that you were in the situation with revenge. You're becoming what you don't like. You're becoming what you don't like. So picture this situation. Let's say somebody has a hypercritical mother. And she visits your apartment. She begins immediately, like she barely took her coat off. Can't you clean up the counter? It's dirty. Just clean it up. Okay, you offer coffee. What kind of coffee do you have? That's what you like? That's what you buy? Okay, whatever. Now, another 15 minutes of this, and some people are going to say, look, if you don't like it, you don't have to drink the coffee. You know, it's okay. What do you like? It's enough already. Now, at that time, it feels wonderful initially, just like revenge does, because you've equalized the situation. She can't belittle you. She can't make you small. And you may even feel, how should I phrase this? I've heard people describe it like a freedom fighter. You finally won. You feel like David facing down Goliath because you felt so small and she seemed so big. But what have you become? You've become Goliath. So you've moved from being David to Goliath. That's not who you want to be. So being a human being, what could you do in a moment like that? So what you have to do is make the other person smaller, more human, and less scary in your eyes. See her for what she is. See her as a person who's critical, who may not have enough going on in her own life to get beyond the minutiae of your life. Somebody who would like affection and like control and probably has neither. See her as being who she really is. Don't let her stay 9 feet tall in your mind. Bring her down to 5'4" or whatever she really is. If you could bring her down to your level, I didn't say less than your level, and this is critical, then your need to strike back will be diminished. But you do have a better choice still. The better choice still is, instead of bringing her down to your level, and again, an unacceptable choice is bringing her below your level, is raising yourself up, moving into a nurture mode. So I heard somebody describe this once as a patient-doctor mode, rather a doctor-patient mode. Oh, so the patient is showing symptoms, hypercriticism, difficulty. So you become the doctor. What would you say if you were a doctor, a social worker, a therapist, to someone who's hypercritical? Might you repeat, oh, you see it like this and like this, but is there more? Would you be happier if you saw more? You could enter that role of wanting to nurture the other person's optimism and positivity. But this is tricky if the person who you're working with is your parent, because there are a lot of lines you may end up crossing. But certainly with somebody else, this is a very practical and effective way of dealing with the need to say it back. Okay, another thing to remember in all of these incidences is, again, the formula for emuna that we spoke about last time. The reality is what it is. It is what it is. So again, the reality is that someone criticized you. That's how it is. Stop going forward. It shouldn't be like this. It doesn't have to be like this. Stay in the present, but it is like this. Don't go backwards. This is how she's always been. I remember the time when... Don't go there. Stay in the moment. The moment is right now I'm being criticized, and it's painful. Move into the next step. There's only one address that this could come from. This feeling of smallness could come through your mother or your critical roommate or your neighbor or whomever. It can come through them, but it only comes from Hashem. For whatever reason, Hashem wants you to realize how vulnerable you really are at this moment. As we all sometimes have to come to grips with. And the final step is saying, and given that I'm small and vulnerable, that I'm in this person's control, or I feel that I'm in this person's control, where's my tikkun? So there are several different directions you could take depending on what your life is. One would be, my tikkun here is to write my own script. I will not become smaller than I want to be. I'll be exactly who I want to be in this situation. I'll be a giving person. I'll be a person who maintains a certain level of behavior. I'll be a person who benefits others. I'll be exactly who I want to be. That's one possible response. Another response is what people sometimes call, oh, so that's how somebody feels when you criticize them. Oh, that's how my own kid feels when I criticize her. That's how my husband feels when I criticize him. That's how my girlfriend or my coworker feels when I criticize them. Oh, got it. A third possible response would be, and this probably would be the highest of all the responses, and therefore is, of course, the one that's most difficult to come by. It's no coincidence that Hashem had this person cross my path. How could I help them? And what could I learn from them? So you have three possible responses other than revenge, bearing a grudge, or ona'at dvarim. Other things that affect our relationship. I don't know exactly when you'll be seeing this. I assume it's now. I'm assuming it's live, it's now. In Israel, tomorrow, Tuesday, and Wednesday, in different depending on which community you're in, there's the National Shmirat HaLashon Day. So here in Yerushalayim, in Har Nof, that is, okay, the day in which the shiurim will be taking place is Monday, and the big shiur at night, in Hebrew, which I mean in Israel many people speak Hebrew. That's just how it is. Is Tuesday night, and the big shiur in English is Wednesday night. So this is a remarkable thing. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people participate. And they're all coming from one place. They all recognize the power of speech. So within our context, let's talk about the power of speech and how it changes relationships. So there are different sorts of forbidden speech. We're going to focus on only some of them. One is Lashon Hara, which I'm sure you all know about. Lashon Hara, which would be by definition any kind of speech that's accurate, but either negative or damaging or both. But it's accurate. So let's give an example of that. Your friend got divorced. And you really do know the true story, which is always iffy unless you've heard from both sides, but let's assume that you know the true story. And it's a messy story. So someone says, did you hear? Renee's getting divorced. I wonder what happened. Well, wonder no longer. I'm here. I'll tell it to you from the beginning to the end. Now let's assume it's all true. What's so bad? If her husband didn't want to be spoken about, then he shouldn't have done this, and he shouldn't have done that, and he shouldn't have done the other. And what about Renee's need to be vindicated in the community? And what about your own need, as somebody who loves justice and truth, to inform people about who really was right and who really was wrong? What's wrong with this? So the problem with this is threefold. There's an effect on the person who you're speaking about, an effect on yourself, an effect on your listener. Let's talk about the three effects. The obvious effect, the one that most people are most aware of, is the effect that you have on the person who you're speaking about. This could prevent their remarriage, for instance. And just as an aside, obviously the least reliable person to hear about the other side in a marriage that breaks off is the spouse. Obviously, they don't like the person. Obviously, they're pained by the person. Or obviously, they suffered through the person. So they can't be your only source. But in any case, there's that. And oftentimes what happens is because you trust the person who's talking to you, and you don't know them as a person with any desire to ruin any reputations, you don't know them as a vengeful person or whatever, so you take what they're saying as being absolutely so, but the fact is there's a qualifying feature even then. They could only tell you what they themselves experienced, meaning everything is shaded by their experience. They could say, he's stingy, he's repressive, he's controlling. Translate that. I found him to be stingy, given my expectations. Because my material expectations weren't met, I found him to be repressive and controlling. The obvious question is, what was really available and what's his view of it, which you don't know. So you could trust that she's telling you the truth. This is what she experienced. But there's a vast difference between her truth and the truth. She can only see things through her own eyes. So Lashon Hara, therefore, could do incredible harm to the person who's being spoken about. Now, I gave you the obvious example of a divorce. This takes place in many, many other situations in life. In Shidduchim, girls go out. Somebody says, what was Michael like? Now, you know what you know, meaning your own experience. As soon as any of the information that you give is subjective, then you've crossed the line. So if you say, he was so dull, it was just like impossible for me to keep my eyes open. I don't know how I survived this state. Translated, I found him to be dull. I had trouble focusing. Does that mean that everybody in the world will have the same experience? No. So that's subjective. So interestingly, with Lashon Hara, there's no middle ground. Either required to say something or forbidden to say something. So let's go back to our two examples. Why did the couple get divorced? In general, you're required not to say anything. Why? Because unless the person who you're speaking to is an expert marriage counselor who's trying to get them back together, and for whatever reason they brought you into the picture, who's going to benefit by this? No one. However, in the other example, sometimes there's a benefit. Somebody says, well, what was Michael like? Why should they waste their life and their emotions and their time and possibly even their money if they go have their hair done or whatever on Michael when there is no way, no shape, no form that Michael is good for them to meet? So here are some critical words you might learn to say. One is, I don't know. I don't know if you would like him or not. I can only tell you my own experience. Obviously, I'm not seeing again, so he's not for me. And then maybe tell her everything that you found negative in positive words. You found him boring because he talks about his own concerns. Somebody else might find that open and informative. Okay, you found him nervous. Somebody else may find this sort of poetic and high-strung. So you could describe something accurately, but positively. The best thing, of course, is that unless the issue at hand is something that's likely to affect marriage in the future, not to say anything at all. You don't have to know everything. This is especially true, by the way, with age. You don't have to know exactly what someone's age is. You could say, around my age, give or take. I don't know, she probably is what she looks like, whatever it is. It's not your role in general, unless the person's already at a point where their age will affect their marriageability. But otherwise, you don't have to say anything. Why? Because of the disastrous effect on the speaker. The person who we're speaking about. Now let's talk about the effect on you, the speaker. So again, Lashon Hara is marvelous. First of all, it gives you a lot of attention. in addition to giving you a lot of attention, you become an expert without having learned any expertise in anything. And when you talk about people disparagingly, especially if you have some wit and some cleverness, it puts you in a position of immediate superiority. Why is that bad for you? So the fact is, every time you say anything negative about another person, it changes the way you look not only at that person, but at people in general. So an example of that would be, you don't have nasty six-year-olds, the kind to say, "Go away." You don't have that. You do have nasty old people. It takes, 50, 60 years of negativity to get there, but you get there. So every time you make a negative statement about anyone, you're getting a step closer to losing your own ability to see the world accurately, which is a heavy thing to think about. Then you have the listener. So the listener is less in control than you, the speaker, are. You can control what you say. They can't control what they're hearing. So sometimes there's a situation where a person could tell from what's being discussed, this is going to be Lashon Hara, let's tune out. But sometimes it comes warninglessly. So here it is, you have a person who had no particular opinion about someone else, and you've just given them a negative opinion. So there's two things wrong with that. One is your projection may be inaccurate. It may be accurate, factual, but still inaccurate in terms of the bigger person. You're not getting the whole picture. You're getting the part of the picture you're focused upon accurately that's far from being the whole picture. That's one point. The other point is people tend to hear what you didn't say. So oftentimes if you say something like, "She's no student," what does the listener hear? "She has no brains. She's out there." You say someone isn't handy, what do they picture? An authentic nerd. So you have to be very, very careful. Not just for your own sake, but for the sake of your listener. So that would be Lashon Hara. So that's destructive, even more, in a certain sense, than, let's say, taking revenge is destructive. Why? When you take revenge, you uplift yourself by lowering somebody, or at least create the illusion that you did. With Lashon Hara, even the illusion of superiority is so patently false, so completely irredeemable, that it's all completely evil. Okay, there are other forms of forbidden speech. Another form of forbidden speech is motzi shem ra, which means making someone a bad name. So what that means is saying something that's false, but damaging or belittling. So you could say, well, why would anybody do that? So the answer is, we love having opinions on everything. So if you don't have enough information to make a fact-bound opinion, it's not hard to make a not fact-bound opinion, just any opinion. Oh, this is how all the Hasidim are. All the Hasidim? This is how all of the yeshiva people are. Who exactly? So all these broad generalizations tend to be rechilas. Also, repeating what somebody else confided in you, what a third person confided in you. You may not be aware of this, but for your own good, I feel you should know what people say. Who said it's for their good? It's almost never for their good. Okay, so that would involve forbidden speech. Okay, there's also a mitzvah to love your fellow person, which we spoke about briefly last time. I'm going to review it this time. I'm going to take it further. So the three dinim, as you might recall, were speaking well of people, meaning someone does something good, inspirational, positive, using your common sense, find the right audience to tell it to. Not a competitor, not someone who dislikes them, possibly not using their name, but find someone, because the same way Lashon Hara makes you negative, when you repeat positive stories, It makes you see the grace and goodness of Hashem himself as his soul. He's the soul of the world, filters down into the human soul. From this perspective, we also have respecting people, treating people with respect, eye contact, not going away while they're still talking, everything that says you're interesting. What you have to say is important because you're human. So that's respect. So of course, when you give respect to somebody else, you yourself change. You see other people's messages as relevant and important. And I want to tell you something funny. This is just a side dividend. It's not a cause of this mitzvah. But if you really see this in people, you know what happens? They'll reveal more of their positive self to you. I'll give you an example. I was visiting someone in an old age home with a friend. And when we were there, the friend clearly wanted her to feel respected, which in modern language would mean validated, acknowledged, appreciated. So there was a small picture of her grandparents. And she said, and who are these? Now, clearly it was her grandparents. It was a picture of this couple in Morocco in a photo studio. So what that led to, that one question, was her revealing a lot more what it was like to live in Morocco in those days, what it was when she came to Israel. Much more personal revelation in the positive sense, not in the true confession sense, than one would have expected. Now the opposite of this, and I find this very distressing because I'm finding this sort of a book more and more popularized in the religious world, is the sort of book where you're the hero, everybody else is the villain. In fact, someone gave me a manuscript, I hoped it won't be published as is, but it was like the religious version of a book you may be familiar with, Mommy Dearest, where the person writing it was ignored, and her mother was insensitive, her father was even more so. No physical abuse, but extreme insensitivity. And how bored she was, how desperate for affection. Let's say it's all true. The author is going to be writing under her own name. Everybody will know who she's talking about. What could be less respectful than this? Even if she were to change her name so that you and I, the listeners, so to speak, don't know exactly who these parents are, still the negativity has now become part of our possibility list. Watch out, some parents are this and this and this and this. It's not good. Okay, another form of making bond is praying for someone. Oftentimes people say, what could you do? All you could do is daven. And that means to some people it translates as you can't do anything. It's not true. The way davening works is that it has enormous, enormous force if you're sincere. I just spoke to a man this morning. It was a remarkable story. A religious man. And he had terrible symptoms that came upon him suddenly. Terrible pain in one eye, in the back of the eye, so to speak. And the doctor told him that he has cluster headaches, a form of migraine. And it didn't ring true to him because he had never had migraines before, and for it to come suddenly with such force seemed somewhat inexplicable. But the doctor gave him a painkiller, a very powerful painkiller. It didn't work. And he was literally howling with pain. He had no place to put himself. So finally his wife said, we have to go to the emergency room. This is unbearable. So he went to the emergency room in Hadassah, and they did a whole battery of tests, which took place over days. They didn't find anything. Okay, so he's back. He's on these same ineffectual painkillers. This time they gave him something stronger that worked a little bit better. But nothing really worked. They went back to the emergency room, and this time a young doctor tried some other test that the other doctors had not noticed or whatever, and he discovered that it was a bacterial infection. Who knows how he got it? They're still trying to figure out, was this from contact with the earth itself? Maybe there was some dead animal there. Was he in contact from people from different countries? Whatever. Why am I telling you this? Because his first words, I called up and I wanted to see how he's doing. His first words were, the tefillah was machriya the din. He got it. He really got it. It could have gone either way. The doctors were the first to tell him it could have gone either way. But he understood what that meant. That meant Hashem, who could have easily, using the rules of nature, have it go either way, saved him. And since the only variable here was tefillah, he knows where it came from. So when you daven for people, and you really feel, you feel their pain, you feel their anguish in not knowing the right person if you're davening for someone for a shidduch, you know their anguish in going from job to job, whatever it is. When you daven for somebody else, you become more enlightened, which in turn may affect you enough that whatever it is that you were davening for could come to you more readily. Don't hear what I didn't say. I didn't say daven for someone with any level of sincerity or no sincerity, and surely God will give you exactly what you want when you want it because you ordered it. It's not exactly like that. Another way to bond to people is by noticing, by having eyes that notice. Do people look at ease? Do they look stressed? Is there something you could do to alleviate the stress? When you begin to look, you see people as much more vulnerable than you realized they were. This old lady really needs a chair. It's very crowded in this room. Maybe I should open the window. Whatever it is, by your forcing yourself into the role of giver, you become a very much different and expanded person. Okay, more things. Let's go to concrete issues. Okay, one of the things that cause people an enormous amount of misunderstanding on money matters. So let's talk briefly about money matters, not because we're going to be expert dayanim by the time we finish, but we'll have at least some idea. Now, why is some idea better than nothing? When the children begin studying Talmud in the partner system, the chavrusa system, the first, oftentimes, their beginning gemara is hamafkid, which is talking about leaving security with somebody and whether they're allowed to use it, not allowed to use it. So someone went to Rav Moshe Feinstein and said that we have to change this. So he said, why? He said, these are kids. They're 8, they're 9, they're 10. They don't have clients. Nobody puts any securities in their hands. They don't have to guard anything. Why not begin with something that they're familiar with, that's relevant to their lives? So Rav Moshe said, for instance, what? And the person said, like the laws of the Shema. They say Shema every day. That would be relevant. So Rav Moshe wouldn't go for it. He said, nothing is more relevant than knowing what's yours is yours and not mine. That's relevant. So it's worth knowing these laws, at least on the outside. So I'm going to just take you through some of the laws, a few of them. Okay, one is that any time you borrow something, okay, your obligation is to give it back. If no date is set, then the arbitrary time for return is 30 days. So again, if someone says that they're lending you something for a half a year, that's fine. But if they didn't say anything at all, it has to be returned no later than, it could be earlier, no later than 30 days later. Next thing, if something happens to the object, it's basically your responsibility if you borrowed it. They didn't ask you to take it. You're not doing them any favor. So there's no reason they should suffer because something happened to their possession. This would include theft. This would include all sorts of things that may not be your fault either. But again, you're the one who asked for it, so you're the one who's responsible. When you give something back, you have to give it back in the way you got it. What do I mean by in the way? Let's say you needed a loan and somebody sent you a check in the mail. When you give back the check, you could send it in the mail. Why? Because by virtue of their having sent it in the mail, that shows you that they trust the mail system. So if they trust it for them, they could trust it for you. Having said that, if you go for a loan and they don't send it by mail, they send it by messenger. There's a knock on the door, some yeshiva bachur's there, he has, oh, this is an envelope from Mr. Whomever. That means you have to give it back personally. You can't just throw it in the mail. Obviously, the person doesn't trust the mail. And they're the ones who are setting the stage. Now let's look. If you're renting something, you didn't borrow it, you rented it. It's a whole different story. Since somebody is renting out an object, let's say you did a private car rental, which in Israel is legal. I don't know if it's legal in the States or not, where you could pay someone to let you use their car. So as soon as they're taking money from you, they could expect a certain amount of wear and tear. How much? Normal wear and tear. So the question is, what's normal? So obviously every object is different. It's fair to say that if you borrow somebody's blower dryer, I don't know if you ever experienced dryer death, but you know, you put it in the plug, you turn it on, it's working, and then suddenly you smell this sort of acrid plastic burning smell. So you pull out the plug and you see it's like the motor is very, very overheated, like you could fry an egg on the top of the blower dryer. All right, it got overheated, you let it cool down. You let it cool down, you put the plug back in, and nothing. No noise, no movement, no nothing. That's called death. That's called blower dryer death. So in this case, if you didn't misuse it in any way whatsoever, you were using it according to the directions, you didn't have it on very, very long, that's compared to an animal that dies because it just got old. So you wouldn't have to pay for this. However, if the lender insists that you make an oath, it could be that under certain circumstances you would have to swear that you didn't do anything to hasten its demise, like dropping it into a bucket of water, for instance. So that's with rentals. So again, unlike borrowing, when you rent something, you're only liable for negligence or purposeful damage. You're not negligent for you're not liable for every single thing that happens. Okay, another possibility. You're being paid. Somebody is paying you to take care of their things. I don't know if this happens much in the States, but in Israel, being a house babysitter is not unusual in the summer. People go back to the States to see their families. They want their plants watered. They want people to see people walking in and out so the house doesn't look abandoned. So hire someone. So if you're hired, you're basically liable for everything when you when you take this job for at least the hours that you're there. Okay, next thing is wages. So the responsibility of making a clear contract, whether it's verbal or written, is on the person who does the hiring. So there shouldn't be misunderstandings later. This is what you expect, and this is what you're paying. So therefore, if you go into a taxi, don't wait until you're going out to ascertain in Israel that he indeed turned on the meter. You have to say that to begin with, or set a price with him. But you can't wait until the end, because then basically you've relinquished control. Okay, so if in a situation like this, the employer has to set the tone. Now here's another thing that the employer has to be aware of. It's a mitzvah to pay on time. That means if somebody does work for you during the day, you should pay them before nightfall. If they did work for you at night, pay them before daybreak. Obviously, sometimes it's impossible, but it's very good if you could make it possible. Most of the time when people hire someone, they know whether or not they have the money right now. Better wait until you have the money to do the hiring, unless there's a reason otherwise. Now, if you really, really don't have the money, which could happen, but you will, then you're not considered guilty. Then you're considered to be dealing in good faith. But it would have been more appropriate for you to tell the person to begin with that their wages will be delayed. Okay, let's say you're working for someone and they don't pay you, but there are all sorts of things of value that you could take and sort of even things out. For instance, you're a secretary for somebody who has you working on the computer all day, and he says he has a cash flow problem. You have options. There may be a bouquet of flowers there. There may be a private little coffee, whatever there is. You have some right to it, but not without the permission of the Beis Din. So if you're owed money, the only way you could take it through the other person's possessions is through the permission of the Beis Din, which usually won't be forthcoming, but at least you have grounds to bring the person to trial. Now, if the person hired you knowing full well that they don't have the money, then it's your responsibility to actually take them to court. Don't be Mr. Nice Guy. If you act like Mr. Nice Guy in this situation, then you could first of all turn them into a thief, and you won't get your money because their obligation towards you begins from the moment you ask for your wages. So if you refrain from asking, then you're giving them inappropriate leeway. That would be that sort of a damage. Okay, taking this further, okay, you also have, and this is something people should be aware of, damage done by children. One day you'll have children, and one day they'll do damage. So I was listening to a woman. There was a shiur in a certain city, and the woman was very indignant. Her child and another boy, I think it was in seventh grade, I don't remember, they had a fight. So it's this one pushes this one, and that one's shooting him with his water gun. They have a fight. So the fight ends during recess with this sort of chase over the desks in the classroom, with the other guy losing and her son winning. And then, here's the nightmare, the principal comes in, and he sees the overturned chairs, the desks. So he caught her son red-handed, on the desk, literally, takes him into the office, berates him for around 5 minutes, and sends a note home to the parents demanding 90 shekel for repairs for the furniture. Now this woman, I can't even begin to tell you how indignant she was. How dare he? How dare he berate my child? And certainly to ask me for 90 shekels, totally unreasonable. It's not so simple that he's wrong, even though I presented it as though he's wrong. Certainly the child having the lack of decorum in Derech Eretz to run over public property has to be addressed. They have to understand that the menahel, or whoever runs the school, has to raise money, and that raising money involves travel and stress, sometimes humiliation. Okay, they have to know that. But the bottom line is you don't have to pay for your kids' damage, and I'll tell you why. They're so unpredictable that nobody could possibly know authentically what they're doing, unless the child has already done the same thing more than once, and you could watch out for that. But in terms of chinuch, letting the child do damage and not paying for it is not a good idea. Okay, other forms of damage. Damage that's done by your own body. You knock over a glass with your arm. You trip somebody with your foot. The basic rule is if it happened directly through your body, you always are the liable one. Now, a person could waive their rights. You're in the store, you knocked something over by accident, and the proprietor says, no, don't worry. You don't have to worry. But if the proprietor is in silent meditation, meaning he wants you to pay for it, you have to pay for it. That's the way it goes. Someone has to pay for it, and why should it be the storekeeper? Now, there are leniencies in certain cases where Well, you would say, well, what did the storekeeper think? He thought that he could leave out all of these rings and none of them will be touched or whatever. But it depends on the situation at hand. Okay, last thing, physical damage that you do. You're always liable for physical damage. There are no leniencies there. The excuse, he told me to do it, like, let's say, a mafia gunman, is not an excuse in halacha. Adam mu'ad la'olam, which means a person is always on. Okay, so with this, we're completing our law, our little survey. We didn't go very deeply, obviously. Our little survey of laws between man and fellow man. So just to tie things up, we spoke about material honesty, we spoke about borrowing, we spoke about lending, we spoke about renting, we spoke about lashon hara, we spoke about believing lashon hara, we spoke about ona'ah, and we reviewed sinat chinam and ahavat chinam. I left a little bit of time now on purpose, which I really usually don't do. If you have any questions having to do with human relations, especially at this time of year, when we're supposed to be moving towards ahavat chinam, which means loving someone for no good reason, they didn't do anything particularly lovable, but because they're your fellow Jews, you'll feel this bond of empathy with them and want things to be good for them. So this is what we have to strive towards, and we would do this by the reverse of all of the things we said in the negative. But as I said, I'm leaving a little bit of time for question. I'll count. One, two, three. Nobody has any questions. You all have everything that has to do with human relations together. Okay. So I'm going to conclude then with one more thing. One can go on with this very long. Realize to say we scratched the surface isn't even being honest. We didn't scratch the surface. But, you know, we did something. Okay, another thing that has to be said is that everyone is considered to... Okay, one moment. What if we're afraid of someone because they hurt us? So that's a reasonable question. So if you're talking about being physically hurt, which you probably are not, then you do have to create physical distance. But you still have to look at what's admirable and godlike and good about them and try to benefit them. Now, if you're afraid of, the person asked, what if they attacked in private? So if you're talking about physical damage, then you still have to distance yourself physically. You're responsible for your own body and its well-being. You're not allowed to put yourself in any form of physical danger, which includes being abused by anybody physically, whether this is a parent or a sibling or a spouse. You're not allowed to allow for abuse. If what the person means is verbal abuse or embarrassment, hurt feelings and all of this, so you're allowed to preserve this by trying to distance yourself from the person emotionally while still maintaining a caring attitude towards them. So on a practical level, it means basically learning how to disregard what they say to a large degree. Saying this is how this person feels. They themselves are wounded or suffering or whatever, for whatever reason. Or they have limitations and flaws, as we all do. So you have to accept that this is a flaw and a limitation and not let yourself be hurt by it, by creating emotional distance. But you would still have to care for them physically as you would to any other person. You would still have to treat them respectfully. You would still have to speak well of them. Any more questions? Okay. So we should be worthy of loving other people just because they're human and Jews and beautiful underneath all of their stuff and have a soul that comes from the same place that our own souls came from. And again, loving means to cherish connection and warmth. So have a very good rest of the summer, and we'll be together after.